From the studios of KPCW in Park City, this is Cool Science Radio.
Science and technology that's accessible and entertaining.
If we can understand it, you can understand it.
I'm Lynn Ware Peake.
And I'm John Wells.
Our next guest is Jeff Hawkins, who has written a new book called A Thousand Brains, A New Theory of Intelligence. Hawkins is the co-founder of Numenta, a neuroscience research company. Now, he and his research team study the part of the brain responsible for everything we associate with intelligence and then apply these findings to machine learning. He's also the founder of the Redwood Neuroscience Institute. Jeff Hawkins, welcome to Cool Science Radio. It's great to have you.
It's great to be here. Thank you for having me on.
Certainly. Well, let's just start with this new part of the brain. Well, not the new part of the brain, but it is called the neocortex. So enlighten us about the neocortex. We feel like we haven't really talked a lot about the neocortex.
Well, we should, because it is by far the largest part of a human brain. It's about 70% of the volume of our brain. Everyone's familiar with it in some sense. If you look at a picture or a drawing of a brain, you see the big wrinkly sheet of cells around the outside of the brain. That's the neocortex. It's about the size of a large dinner napkin, but pretty thin. It's only about 2.5 millimeters thick. And as you said, it is the organ of intelligence. Almost everything we think about as intelligent part of our lives, from how our sensations of touch and hearing and sound and language and our thoughts and planning, engineering, science, it's all done by the neocortex. So if we want to understand intelligence, we really have to understand how the neocortex works.
You kick off your book with the first part, which is a new understanding of the brain. And, you know, it's funny, Jeff, since we have been doing this show, Cool Science Radio, just under a decade, you know, we came into it and the average layperson, remember that saying about how we only use 10% of our brains, which has long ago been dismissed. And then about, 7 years ago, we started to hear reports on the malleability of the brain that we never knew existed. And now it seems like there's this new era of brain research having to do with a lot of the things that you're talking about in the book. And it just makes me curious about, you know, where neuroscience is going and where, in part, you are taking it.
Well, neuroscience is a huge field. It's one of the largest scientific fields. There are tens of thousands of neuroscientists, and they do a lot of different things. So it's not one monolithic field of study. And it's been a challenging field in many ways, because it's very difficult to study the brain. You've got all these individual cells, which are very, very small. They're hard to record from. And so a lot of people study simple brains of animals, or insects. When it comes to the human brain, it's very, very difficult to study that directly. So I just want to point out there's not like one monolithic field of neuroscience. But almost all neuroscientists are interested in the human brain one way or the other. I mean, we should all be. We're all humans, and our brain defines us. And so what's happened recently is there have been new techniques that allow us to get the kind of data that we need, whether it's we're getting it from other mammals, such as a rat or a mouse, or even from humans in non-invasive ways. But we're starting over the last, I'd say, 20, it's been growing all the time, but over the last 20 years specifically, there's been a tremendous growth in our ability to just look at the details that's going on in the brain under different tasks. And that's given us this huge collection of data. And what my team and I do is we try to make sense of that data. There hasn't been any real overarching theories about how the neocortex works, even though it's such an important part of our brain. It's really been a sort of a mass of data we've had, but people have struggled to sort of make sense of that data. And that's what we do. And we've made some significant progress, I believe, in sort of piecing together all this new research, is sort of what I call unassimilated data, like data that we have about the brain that's unassimilated to theory, and then making sense of it. And so now we have a pretty good idea what's going on in the neocortex.
If you're just joining us on Cool Science Radio, we're having a conversation with Jeff Hawkins, who has written A Thousand Brains, A New Theory of intelligence. And if you were hanging out in the early 90s and you were communicating with people around the world, you were probably, and you may have been using a Palm Pilot. Jeff is the founder of Palm Pilot and mobile computing. Jeff, I wanted to ask you, can you take us through the thousand brain theory that you have and how this all comes together?
Yeah, I can try to do it. Let's take just a few sentences. the first thing to do is to think, you have to think about what is the neocortex doing. It's tempting to think of it like a computer, like it's getting some input from your eyes or your skin and then it processes it. But that's not really the right way to think about it. What the neocortex does is it learns a model of the world. So we're all looking out or hearing me speak or seeing something right now and say, oh, it's obvious I see this stuff. But to understand what you're seeing, you actually have a model of it in your head. It's almost like a CAD model, computer-aided design model. It's literally your neocortex is taking all your knowledge of the world and storing it in a way that sort of replicates the world itself. So it's building a model of the world, and that's what we do when we learn. We're not just collecting facts. We're learning where things are relative to each other, how they behave, how they interact, and so on. So then the question is, how does the neocortex build that model of the world? And the thousand brain theory sheds a really important light on that. The name thousand brain theory comes from the fact that surprisingly, and this is surprising to us, we didn't know this 5 years ago, that the model of the world in your head is actually divided up into thousands and thousands of separate models. They're associated with what are called cortical columns. These are small elements of the neocortex. And a human has about 150,000 of these in your neocortex. And so each of those 150,000 cortical columns is actually a modeling system. They model different parts of the world. Some model input from the retina, some model input from the skin, some model input from sound, some model input from other parts of the brain. But there's thousands and thousands of models. So if I ask something like, well, where do I store knowledge about a coffee cup? And I know what coffee cups are like. I have a particular one in front of me right now. It's not in one place. It's distributed in many, many, many models. And then the models, the reason you don't perceive this is that the models vote. They're like, they're all trying to figure out what's going on in the world. And they send the signals between each other. And they're saying, well, I think I'm feeling something like this. And I'm feeling something like that. And I'm seeing something like this. It could be this. It could be that. And they vote and reach a consensus. And this is how all of our senses get unified. So the first thing is the brain's learning a model. The neocortex is. The second is it's the distributed model of thousands and thousands of independent models and they vote together. And that's where the term thousand brains come from. But the other key discovery we made is the key to understanding how these models are created. What do they look like in neurons? How do neurons actually create a model of the world? It seems like a hard thing to imagine them doing that. And I'll just briefly mention it here, but they create something called reference frames, which most of your listeners will be familiar with. Cartesian coordinates in high school that you learned X, Y, Z, that's a type of reference frame. Reference frames allow you to specify the location of something. And it turns out the neurons actually create reference frames for all the objects in the world that you're familiar with. And knowledge is stored as part of these reference frames. So those are all the major components of the thousand brains theory. And it is not how we or anyone else thought of it, even just 5 years ago.
So I have this neocortex, and I have these cortical columns, and last night I'm drinking a cup of tea after dinner, and I'm imagining a cortical column for tactile feel of my cup of tea, the shade of the cup, a separate cortical column, a separate cortical column or a separate location for the weight of that cup before the tea's in it, the weight after the tea's in it, the warmth coming from the cup, the form of the cup. And it is just fascinating to me thinking about how it's all combined into a single perception in what I believe is real time as it informs my world. How does this binding process work? What did we know about it before? And I know that you all have discovered some new things about this binding process.
Yeah, it's called the binding problem because people really couldn't figure out how it worked. You can express it in different ways. Just like you express it very eloquently, talking about the cup and the tea and all the different elements of it. You can even think of it this way too. Another very related to this problem is the fact that I'll give you another example. Your eyes are constantly moving, right? And I mean, 3 times a second, they're moving. And you're not aware of this. You don't perceive it. If you're looking at something, that thing seems stable, even though your eyes are moving, this is a fact. And every time your eyes move, the input to the brain changes completely. Yet you're not aware of that. And that's another example of the binding problem. How come all these changing inputs don't appear? They somehow just seem this singular perception, just like your cup of tea. Also, when you move your fingers over your teacup, well, the cup doesn't feel like it's moving, but the patterns on the sense of your skin are changing constantly. So the way this, we're pretty confident how this works is this voting process that's going on. If you imagine all these cortical columns, imagine they're coming from the retina or they're coming from your skin. And as you move your eyes and move your fingers, the inputs of these columns are changing rapidly, several times a second. And yet your perception is stable. So what's going on is that there's these set of neurons in each column that are basically represent the underlying object, the thing that you're touching or seeing. And those are the neurons that vote. Those are the neurons that everybody is saying, I think it might be A, and someone else saying, I think it might be A or C, and someone else says it could be this or that. And those neurons vote, and once they figure out what you're seeing or touching, or what you have your coffee cup in your hand, they stay stable even though the other neurons keep changing. And this happens in every column. These voting neurons go all over the brain, and it turns out that is what you perceive. You're not able to perceive the activity in inside of each column. You're only able to perceive this voting mechanism. And that's why the world seems stable. The world doesn't seem jumping around as you're moving your eyes and moving your fingers. And it's not the binding problem is solved not because all these inputs come into one spot, which is the way people used to think about it. Like, okay, where does the binding occur? There didn't seem to be a place for that to occur in the brain. And we now know it doesn't occur. What happens is the voting solves the binding problem. Voting is a way of all the different models saying, okay, we all agree this is what's going on in the world right now. And it doesn't happen in one place. It's happened over the entire neocortex.
So, Jeff, having solved this binding problem and explaining brain stability, does that explain how when the connections and the, you know, some of the various votes are interrupted by something such as, concussion or even an overabundance of emotion that's being experienced about, say, a cup of tea, which is a bad example because we usually don't have emotion surrounding a cup of tea, but are there just different connections that are so quickly made that it's just like hitting a reset button and new votes in different areas are being taken, producing kind of the same thing?
There's two things, I think, in your question, and I'm going to try to tease them apart. One is like something emotional happened. Of course, in your cortex, it's not your entire brain. The other parts of your brain are really important. And we think about emotional states, whether I'm feeling something happy or angry or fearful, those are being generated not in the neocortex, but by older parts of the brain. Those are somewhat more primitive parts of the brain. And of course, the neocortex and the older part of the brain are highly connected. So the neocortex is actually, as I say, it's an unfair position because it's not in control. It's actually the older parts of the brain are more in control. And the neocortex is there to help out in some sense. If you see something that creates an emotional response, that's just going to dominate the entire brain system. It's going to send neuromodulators to the brain, these chemicals that change your mood, and you really can't control that very well, not easily. So that's one aspect of what you're saying. It's like the neocortex is not really in control. It's there to serve the old brain. It's there to serve biology and our procreation. So something important happens, you see an attractive person or you get hungry or something fearful occurs, you know, then the old brain takes over and says, let's do this. But there's another part of it, which I think you were kind of alluding to, too. The brain, the cortex has a model of the world, and the model is what we call a predictive model. Mm-hmm. And it means it's constantly making predictions about what you're going to feel and see and hear. You're not aware of most of these predictions, but it's constantly doing it. And we know that it's happening because if anything is different than normal, you notice it right away. Mm-hmm. If you're holding a cup and all of a sudden you feel it has a little square edge, where this particular cup is not supposed to have a square edge, it jumps to your attention. That's because the cortex is making the prediction what it's going to feel, even if you're not aware of it. And when it feels something wrong, it says, that's not right. We have to attend to this. So what happens often is if you are going about your world and something is unusual or unexpected, it immediately draws your attention to it. And the cortex, you can't control it. It's just going to happen. You can't say, don't pay attention to that. It's just going to happen.
Right.
And what's going on here is the cortex says, well, there's something wrong with my model of the world. So let's attend to that thing and fix the model of the world so that, you know, I'm not surprised. So those are two ways that the cortex gets derailed from what you might think of normal processing.
Okay. Well, okay, so this human ability of making predictions is not necessarily flawless, but it's pretty darn good. But as you have been explaining it, it sounds a lot like machine learning or artificial intelligence. We know that these models are helping to just increase a machine's ability to make predictions. And yet, you sort of make the case that machine or artificial intelligence is not really all that intelligent. So let's get into that next part of your book.
Okay. Do you want me to lead or you want to ask a question?
No, go ahead and let me. Yeah. Well, the question is, why do you say it's not so intelligent? And how flawed is it compared to our ability, the human brain, to be predictive?
So first of all, I think today's AI techniques, which are sometimes known as deep learning networks or neural networks or convolutional neural networks, they're really good. And they're very powerful and they're very valuable. And so I'm not critical of them. But I think most people, even most AI practitioners today, will agree that they're nothing like human intelligence. They don't exhibit any of the flexibility that we have. The number of things that a human can do, the number of tasks we can learn is just incredible. We have language. We can do mathematics and science. We can create radio shows. You know, we solve problems. We use tools. We speculate about the nature of the universe. none of these things that today's AI can do. Most AI today is basically some sort of pattern classifier, if you will, mm-hmm. very valuable, but nowhere near the capabilities of a human. And if you just spend a little bit of time thinking about that, you come to this conclusion. So that's not really a controversial statement. I think the question is that perhaps a little bit more controversial is, how do we get to creating truly intelligent machines? Can we do more of what we're doing today? Can we just take, you know, the kind of networks we have today and make them bigger or faster or give them more data? Or do we have to do something fundamentally different? And this is perhaps where I might differ from some of my colleagues. I don't believe we can get to truly intelligent machines doing more of what we're doing today in AI. We've learned enough about the brain to know how it works at some level. And these principles we've learned in hindsight seem obviously essential. You can't get around them. I can talk about them a bit, if you will, if you want. So it's like we need to, it's not going to be just do more of what we're doing today. And I make the argument in the book that we have to pay attention to the principles we've learned about the brain if we're going to create truly intelligent machines, which I believe are going to be just wonderful things to have in this century. They're going to transform this century in the same way that computers did in the last century. So I'm pretty optimistic about that, but we're going to have to pay attention to the principles of which the brain works.
We're speaking with Jeff Hawkins. He's written 1,000 Brains, A New Theory of Intelligence. It's broken into three parts: a new understanding of the brain, machine intelligence, and human intelligence. It's kind of like three books in one. And Jeff, I wanted to mention that with all of the information in your book, it's got me asking questions and thinking about all of these different things, which I think is probably one of your objectives, which is to get people to talk about this stuff. Is that correct?
That is right. I guess I'm somewhat surprised how few people. I consider these topics important. From a commercial value point of view, but important from a human society and human, the human experience. And I think there's a number of topics which people just don't generally talk about. And so I, I took the opportunity in this book not only to describe a new theory of how the brain works, but to talk more broadly about the role of intelligence in our lives and intelligence, importance of intelligence for us as a species. And so I did go pretty far afield. And you're right, it's almost like three books, but they do tie together because it's all about...
Oh, they do. Yeah.
And I also knew that I would alienate some people writing about these topics because I take somewhat different opinions about certain topics. But my goal, as you said, was to really just, you know, here are some things I think that people should be thinking about. Maybe we can have a conversation about this. And especially in the third part of the book, where I, in some sense, I talk about what's the future of humanity and what, you know, what is it we want to accomplish as a species, not just as individuals, but as a species. And, you know, we're so used to just saying, hey, our goal is to survive and have children and survive and have fun, you know. Maybe we'll figure things out. We'll figure out how the universe works. Isn't that great? It is great. But ultimately, you know, our species won't exist forever. That's a fact. And then we can ask ourselves, well, what do we exist for and what are we trying to accomplish? And I make a an argument in the last part of the book, jumping right to the end there, in a chapter called Genes versus Knowledge, maybe it's Knowledge versus Genes. That life to today has all been about, up to this point, has all been about genetics, genes. You know, we're here to propagate genes. That's, you know, that's what Darwin and Richard Dawkins have shown. And I asked the question, should that be our future? Or should our future be to propagate and accrete knowledge? And should we be trying to preserve our knowledge, not our genetic material? And if we take that attitude that what makes humans special is our knowledge and our intelligence, not our genes, but our knowledge, what would we do differently in the future? And then I'm talking about the long-term future, you know, 100,000 years, you know, 10,000 years, that kind of.
Well, I certainly agree with you that understanding binding, for an example, is going to help inform us as we try to build more intelligent machines. And I also believe that reverse engineering the brain is what we need to spend more time focusing on. But I'll tell you an interesting path that I took when I was reading one of your chapters. And that was, if we don't understand our brain, how can we possibly help people who are suffering? And going back to binding for a moment, all the different cortical columns with you know, thousands and thousands of things on the tactile feel or on the shade of the color. When I think about people that are suffering from dementia, it sounds to me, this is just a quick observation, it appears to me, my observation is that maybe they're missing a few pieces of the binding process because they may recognize and then not recognize. So what I'm thinking is, not only can we build more intelligent machines, but we may be able to help people that are suffering.
Yeah, you're absolutely right. And, you know, it's interesting. We have various fields of study, of psychology, psychiatry, and neurology. These are all fields that are related to human issues and problems and diseases. But we have almost no underlying fundamental, you know, substrate of theory about how these things are implemented in the brain. Well, how these, you know, there are many diseases we understand the details for. You know, if you have a neurodegenerative disease, for example. But when it comes to various psychoses, you know, or various different types of personality disorders, there aren't any really sort of fundamental, like, here's how it works and here's what's gone wrong. Even when we educate our children, think about that. We educate our children, we're programming their brains, we're teaching them new things, we're helping them build a model of the world, but we actually don't have any underlying theory about what's going on in their brains while they're learning. And I think how much benefit we could have from that. If we knew what neuronal processes were occurring, we might be able to come up with better ways, not only treating diseases or understanding them, but we have better ways of teaching our kids. So it's understanding the brain or reverse engineering the brain, in my mind, it is the most important scientific endeavor of all time. Even think about, you know, if we think about, oh, well, maybe it's to understand the laws of physics and the laws of the universe. Maybe that's more important. But that can only be done by a brain. Only brains ask questions. Only brains understand the questions. And if we don't understand how brains work, how do we know our answers are correct? How do we know what biases we put into them? So on.
Exactly.
So to me, getting at the core of how the brain works is sort of the most fundamental thing we could possibly do for everything we do. It's just such an important thing to focus on.
Absolutely. Jeff, we've got just about a minute left, but before we let you go, I wanted to ask you something that I know that everyone sinks their teeth into, and it's this notion of false beliefs. When we talk to our sibling about something that happened when we, you know, lived on University Avenue, and they say, no, that was when we lived on Mayberry Street in that other house. That's when, you know, and it's this false memory, false belief. So with about, you know, 45 seconds or so, can you quickly take us over that?
I have a chapter in the book about false beliefs. It's not about the problem you just mentioned about how our memories change and how we remember things incorrectly. It's more about how different humans can reach different beliefs about the same set of facts in front of us. And this is a problem in the world today. And I think I have a good understanding of it. We don't have time to go into it. But I do give examples of how you can take the same set of facts and arrange them differently in a different type of reference frame. Remember, I talked about reference frames earlier. And you end up with different beliefs and different way of looking at the same facts. And if everybody understood this, if every child in high school was taught how their brains can form false beliefs, I think we'd have a better society.
Mm, that's a great point.
Lynn, we're going to have him back on.
Yes, we will.
Will you come back on and talk to us?
Yeah, sure. It's fun. You guys ask great questions. It's a lot of fun.
Thank you. Jeff Hawkins and his new book, 1,000 Brains, A New Theory of Intelligence. And we are so glad you could join us on Cool Science Radio. We'll talk again soon, Jeff.
Thank you for having me. It's been great.
Thanks for tuning in to Cool Science Radio.
If you enjoyed this episode, please rate us, give us a 5, and leave us a comment.
Take us along on your next adventure to the moon.
If you have any story ideas, please let us know at coolscienceradio@kpcw.org.
Thanks for listening, and hey, tune in next week.